Welcome to How to Save a Planet. This is the show about what we need to do to address climate change and how to make those things happen. Welcome to How to Save a Planet. I'm Anna Ladd, a producer on the show. I'll be hosting today. This is the show about what we need to do to address climate change and how to make those things happen.
Hello, How to Save a Planet listeners. I wanted to tell you about a new way to enjoy our show. You can now get a totally ad-free listening experience on every episode of How to Save a Planet simply by subscribing to How to Save a Planet Plus. With a monthly subscription, you'll get uninterrupted access to our patented, solutions-focused, joke-cracking, journalistically rigorous weekly investigations into how we get ourselves the world we want and need. Now, the show is still 100% free on Spotify for anyone to listen to. But if you're a listener who wants the plus treatment, and you know you do, you can try it today by tapping the banner or by going to spotify.com/howtosaveaplanetplus. That's spotify.com/howtosaveaplanetplus.
Hi, I'm Bill McCuddy, co-host of the Accutron Show podcast, where we have conversations about Americana culture, its evolution, and expressions through time. This episode is dedicated to innovation. For the occasion, we meet with world-renowned chef and restaurateur Daniel Boulud. He's one of America's leading culinary authorities. He'll discuss how innovation is the key to continuing tradition in the future. Download the Accutron Show podcast today.
This episode is brought to you by Persephone Media House. It feels like sustainability is finally getting its moment, but still, it's a complex field changing at breakneck speed. Nobody knows this better than former Apple and Intel executive and host of the Sustainability Decoded podcast, Tim Moen. Joining Tim is co-host Caitlin Kinney, a young sustainability activist balancing the perspective from the front lines. With expert guests, they explore the world of sustainability, cut through the insider jargon, and explain what you need to know. Listen and subscribe to Sustainability Decoded with Tim and Caitlin now, before it's too late.
This spring, we got a voice memo from a listener in Oregon about her family farm.
Hey, How to Save a Planet. My name is Diana, and the purring you hear in the background is a stray cat that occasionally comes in my house named Boo. I grew up on the same farm where my mother grew up and her father grew up and his father lived. The farm I grew up on.
The farm is 126 acres in the Willamette Valley in Oregon. And in the message, Diana told us that one day she and her sister are going to inherit the property, and they're starting to think about the future of the farm. Diana said that she's seen the surrounding area change a lot over her lifetime. And in her eyes, not necessarily for the better. She says she's seen most of the forest cleared and it's flat farmland as far as the eye can see. Other family farms have been bought up by bigger industrial farmers, and her childhood rural schoolhouse has closed as families in the area moved away. And recently, all that change hit pretty close to home.
My best friend growing up watched her family farm get sold recently, and within months after the sale, all of the trees on the property were cut down, and the property was just turned into another monotonous field like all of the others. And it's so painful for me to drive by that place now, and I just can't stand the thought of something like that happening to my family's home. I'm committed to finding a different path. I just don't know what.
Right now, most of her family's land is leased to a big farmer in the region who grows conventionally farmed wheat and rye on the property. And Diana is wondering, is there a better use for that land? Especially because we know that how we use our land has a big impact on climate change. An estimated 23% of greenhouse gas emissions come from agriculture, forestry, and other types of land use.
So I guess I just have a question, which is, if you had 100 acres of land and you cared about climate change and the health of the planet and our communities, what would you do? Thanks.
What would we do? the only reasonable thing. A How to Save a Planet house call.
Welcome to Portland, local time, 11:36. Please stay comfortably seated until the seatbelt sign is off.
Today on the show, we're going to take a trip out to Oregon to help our listener, Diana, try to figure out the most climate-friendly thing she can do with her land. We visited people nearby who have found some unique ways to use their land, things that might be a model for Diana. And our trip took us to some pretty unexpected places.
Right now, it's just a museum to all the things that poop in Central Oregon.
That's all coming up after the break. Welcome back. So after getting this message from our listener, Diana, I flew out to Oregon and hopped in a rental car with How to Save a Planet producer Rachel Waldholz, who was a little skeptical of my driving skills, because to be fair, it has been a while.
When was the last time you drove?
I've been thinking about this. I think it was Christmas 2019.
Okay. I feel very confident about your driving skills.
I don't, but that is okay.
Okay, but I can drive if you would like me to.
Yeah. So we switched drivers because I am a coward. We started making our way out to the farm to meet our listener, Diana. We drove through the Willamette Valley in Oregon, which is this wide agricultural valley sandwiched between the Coast Range and the Cascade Range. It was flat, flat, flat farm fields the whole way there.
1 hour, 2 minutes.
We arrived at the farm about an hour outside of Portland and pulled up at a cute house nestled between beautiful vegetable gardens. Hello.
Hi. Hello. Where should we park?
Oh, right here is great. Okay.
Diana moved back to the area during the pandemic after about a decade away. She had considered moving to the East Coast to pursue a career in writing and publishing, but ultimately decided she wanted to be here, on this piece of land that's been in her family for generations. She and her husband now live in a farmhouse down the road from her parents, and she offered to take us on a walk around the property.
Yeah, let's take a tour. All right.
Diana told us that right now, the property is kind of divided into two chunks. The smaller chunk, about a third of the property, is her favorite part. It's 46 acres of protected forest, managed by her parents with help from a conservation program. Diana's parents have been slowly restoring the forest for the last 15 years, pulling out invasive species and planting native ones. Diana pointed out all the species that are thriving there now.
So we've got cottonwoods, we have bigleaf maple trees, we have Douglas firs, we have ash trees. We have a really lovely kind of understory of snowberries and vine maple, my favorite, flowering currants. There's a mock orange over there that smells great.
How did you learn about all of the different plants that are here?
My mom is a great student of plants. My mom is very afraid of poisonous plants, and so she looks up everything. So she knows what nearly everything is, whether or not it will hurt you if you touch it.
It's a pretty dreamy Pacific Northwest forest, the kind you walk into and hear calming nature sounds and the rest of the world ceases to exist. The trails through the woods are marked with hand-painted signs her dad made. They look like something out of Winnie the Pooh. It's lush and green, and of course, it was raining.
I mean, it's beautiful, right? It's really beautiful. I grew up out here. I got married out here. It's like a part of my autobiography.
But the rest of her land, most of her family's property, doesn't look like this. It's farmland. One half is a 40-acre field of rye, and the other...
This is a 40-acre field of wheat.
Diana's family farmed this land themselves for generations. Everything from chickens to dairy to a failed experiment in ginseng. But in the late 80s, her grandfather started leasing the farmland out to a corporate farmer who has many acres in the valley. It's a good arrangement for her parents, who are able to use the money from the lease to help with upkeep around the property. But over time, Diana has begun to wonder if there is a better way to use the land. Agriculture alone contributes to around 11% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. And Diana's learned that there's farming practices that can potentially help reduce those emissions. But she says she's not seeing them done here.
They're applying fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides. And just the idea of like fence row to fence row, just how they have creeped out. There used to be little roads you could drive down in between the fields, and now even the roads are gone.
Right now, Diana doesn't really have a say in what happens on that 80 acres of farmland. But she's thinking about the future, when she and her sister will inherit the property. And with all she's learned about climate change, she feels drawn to one day change something about the way that 80 acres of farmland is being used.
I feel like, God, I really wish we did something different.
And that is what brings us here today.
To help you figure out what to do.
That's right, How to Save a Planet listeners. If you send a voice memo to us, you too can have podcasters descend upon your farmhouse and tell you what to do. Diana had some ideas for how she wanted to think through the options.
I almost want there to be a score, like per square foot. Like this plan would be the best square foot for capturing carbon, and this plan would be the best square foot for increasing community food security. I don't know. And so I feel like I want like a ranking system in my brain for how to compare them. But
we decided to evaluate our options using four categories. First, climate benefit. Would this option help reduce carbon emissions? Second, community benefit. Will this help people in her community by doing things like growing food? Third, lifestyle. Is this something Diana actually wants to do? And finally, finances. When Diana and her sister take over the land, they'd be okay to lose some of the leasing income the family makes from the farmland now. But they also can't afford to hemorrhage money on a land experiment either. There's still property taxes and upkeep to worry about. So the goal would be to find something financially self-sustaining, so it doesn't meet the fate of her childhood best friend's farm. Sold and flattened. So we set out to find Diana some options. The first thing that came to mind was, what about a solar farm? What better way to help the climate than by generating renewable energy? Especially when one of the barriers to solar development is finding enough land. And it turns out, her parents already had the same idea. They had reached out to a solar developer a few years ago to see if their property was a good candidate. And the developer said, in a word, no. One reason for that, they were told, was that there were other solar farms too close by. And I'd never heard that that could be a problem before. So I talked to an Oregon solar developer about why that might be. She told me that even when landowners want to build solar, sometimes the grid in the area can't handle it. Basically, the lower voltage distribution lines that bring power out to these rural areas, like where Diana lives, don't have enough capacity to handle much new power generation. The developer told me it's not at all uncommon to see these rural distribution lines hit their capacity, even with just a few small solar projects. So sometimes people like Diana's family can't always put solar on their land, even if they want to, because until there's some upgrades to the grid, there'd be nowhere for that power to go. So solar is not going to work for Diana right now. Another thing she thought of was carbon offsets. As a reminder, this is a way for people or companies to get paid for doing things that are supposed to absorb or store carbon from the atmosphere. Diana wondered,
can we plant trees and someone pays us to plant trees? Because we're already doing that for free. So what could we get paid to do that? And I reached out to a couple organizations and was told that the property is too small.
So carbon offsets, also out for now. But we told Diana, don't fear. How to Save a Planet is here, in your house, with microphones, asking questions about your finances. We can help you find some other options. One of those options is having the farmland stay as farmland, but farm it in a way that helps the climate. Diana was interested in this idea of one day replacing the current conventionally farmed fields of wheat and rye with regenerative farming.
I'm really inspired by regenerative farming, something that gives back a little bit, not just takes. So.
Regenerative farming is a concept we've talked about before in the show. If you want to go really in depth, go back and check out our episode, Soil, the Dirty Climate Solution. But for now, think of regenerative farming as a suite of farming practices, like not plowing the land, using cover crops, and rotating crops and animals. These practices aim to cut carbon emissions and, over time, store more carbon in the soil, all while making the land more resilient to extreme weather events and drought. But the problem is, Diana's not able to take over this farm and do regenerative farming herself. She already has a full-time job as a hospital social worker. So she wondered if it was possible to find someone who might be able to take over the lease one day and farm this way on her family's land.
But I'm not really sure how to find a responsible, climate-focused farmer I can lease the land to.
Mission accepted. So we looked around for a regenerative farm that might serve as a model for something Diana could do. Something financially sustainable, where a landowner collaborates with farmers on the land. And we found a pretty remarkable ranch. So producer Rachel Waldholtz and I took a drive out of the valley and into the Cascades to check it out.
Proceed to the route.
I am doing my best, Siri. Diana had to work at the hospital that day, so we promised to report back. We drove to a small town northwest of Bend called Sisters, which looks like it's straight out of a Western. There's an antler furniture store and an expansive antique mall, and on a clear day, there are views of 8 different volcanoes.
Turn right, then arrive at your destination.
We were out in Sisters to check out the Lazy Z Ranch.
All right, and we are to park, turn left at the barn. Don't hit the welder. Or maneuver around the welder was the instruction.
Arrived.
We drove up to meet John Herman. He's the rancher who's 2 years into the process of transforming a former horse boarding facility into a regenerative ranch while collaborating with others on the land.
There he is.
John. And we thought this might be a model for something Diana could do on her land because John never thought he would end up as a rancher, even though he grew up on a traditional ranch in Northern California.
And we had 500 pair of cattle and 10 horses and 10 pigs and a bunch of sheep and goats and dogs and 10 cats and the whole nine yards.
And what did like 10-year-old you think of?
Oh, I hated it. I hated all of it. Couldn't have hated it more. I wanted to listen to records and play my guitar, and my dad just wanted me to huck hay all around the ranch. And
there were lots of things John didn't like about that style of ranching.
The way we did things I knew wasn't sustainable, not only for the earth, but for a family.
He saw the toll that this kind of ranching took on the land. So as John grew up, he moved away from the ranch to do a bunch of non-ranching jobs. He was a youth pastor, a high school teacher. He worked at a brewery. He worked at a shelter. Until years later, he took a trip and found a model that made him think, maybe there's a way to use the land that would be sustainable for my family and the planet.
My wife and I spent a summer in Belgium, and we would go out to the middle of nowhere, and there would be a little farmhouse brewery in a little tiny town, just a family using ingredients from the local community, making these funky, weird beers, and then supporting their community through the sale of those beers. And we thought, what if we got back to a piece of land and used that piece of land in a way that left it better than we found it and left our community better than we found it?
John saw 2 things that he really liked. One, the breweries were a business. There was a product to sell that wasn't just crops or livestock. Making a living that way can be really difficult. So having the business relieved some of the pressure of getting everything possible out of the land. And 2, it was a community space. So John and his wife Renee started looking for a piece of land and settled on the ranch they're at in Sisters. And for the last 2 years, John's been working on converting what used to be horse pasture and hay fields and a poop-filled barn into a meadery. Mead, not meat. Mead, which is wine made from honey. John's kind of a fermentation nerd. Their vision? Raise bees on site for their honey turn those weedy fields into what he calls regenerative bee pasture, and use the meadery as a way to make some money to fund it all.
9 different types of clover, Boston plantain.
John walked us to what looks like a big flowery meadow. It's 3 to 4 feet high in some areas.
The name that we call this is regenerative bee pasture. Alfalfa, phacelia, there's some radish. This is a native one that I didn't plant. This is yarrow. This is an awesome plant for pollinators.
And they're all mixed in here. You don't have like rows of crops.
It's chaos, right?
But there's a method to this chaos. John used regenerative farming techniques, like planting the seeds without plowing, so it doesn't disturb the soil as much, to plant this pasture. The goal is to rebuild the organic matter in the soil, so it better stores carbon, nutrients, and water. In this pasture, it feeds his bees.
So here we have 10 pallets of bees. That's 40 hives.
Those bees make honey from the meadow. Honey that John plans to turn into mead and sell. But also, John doesn't want to do all of this farming himself. He can't. A big part of John's vision for the ranch is collaboration. So, for instance, instead of mowing this pasture himself, he works with an outside cattle rancher who brings his herd by seasonally to graze.
So the cows, as they go through eating, they're stepping on the seeds and replanting it into the soil. They poop and pee. They bring all the water from our watering system out here, pee it out on the ground. That's how we input back into the earth from our own ground. We're not trucking in the input. We are letting them eat it and then put it right back in the ground.
The cows are basically fertilizing and mowing for him, cutting the need for inputs like fertilizer and helping him meet his goals for the soil. This arrangement is a real win-win for the cattle rancher and John, because the cattle rancher has access to the water and cheaper grazing land, which are normally big expenses. This arrangement is pretty different from how Diana's family interacts with the farmer on their land. Instead of a straight lease, this is called a crop share, which means that John isn't just handing over his fields to another farmer. He's contributing to some of the upfront costs, and he has a say in how the land is managed. For instance, how often the cattle have to be rotated.
Whereas a normal lease would be, yeah, you got it. 3 months, it's yours. And not much I can say about it.
And so far, all of this sounded great for our listener, Diana. It sounded like a way she could have regenerative farming on her land without having to do it herself. But John wanted us to know that it can be challenging to find people who are willing to do things this way. And even when you do find the right people, there is a real big problem that Diana should know about.
We're losing tons of money. Yeah. Hand over fist. Every month. It's very, very, very terrifying.
Getting a regenerative farm started from the ground up can take a lot of money. John needed money to replant the fields, money for new irrigation systems, money for legal fees to apply for a permit to open the meadery. The whole goal is for this to be a self-sustaining business one day, but they are nowhere near that yet. So in the meantime, John and his wife Renee are funding everything with savings, his wife's job as a therapist, and with loans.
In fact, I just got another loan from our local credit union, and they're so sweet. They're so great. But he's like, man, good luck.
Which made How to Save a Planet producer Rachel Waldholtz wonder.
Would you recommend it to someone else? For instance, our listener that's considering following you down this path, would you recommend it to them?
Unless you are independently wealthy, think long and hard about it.
After spending the day with John at the Lazy Z Ranch, we took everything we learned back to Diana to see how we did and get her take.
My immediate reaction is like awe and admiration, and also like, whoa, that is super intense and very risky, and like, you would have to be really committed to that vision to pull it off. And I find that really like intense and inspiring at the same time. And I'd have to, I agree with him when he said you have to think long and hard about it. And I'm like, yeah. At this point in my life, taking out a ton of loans is not an option. My family would freak the f*** out. And I would freak the f*** out also because I just spent a lot of money on my master's education. So that's not an option for me. Maybe at some point down the road it would be. But at this precise moment, that's like, whew, I'm not ready. I'm so ready to support everybody who's doing that. But I personally am not ready.
So Diana is not ready to stake her life on starting a farm business like John's and managing farming partners on the land. So we've run through three options for Diana so far: solar, carbon offsets, and managing a regenerative farm. And so far, we have struck out thrice. But we at How to Save a Planet don't give up that easily. We've got one more option to show Diana. And this time, we're taking her with us.
Is this spirea that's blooming?
It is spirea.
I love spirea.
That's coming up after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Ben & Jerry's. In the mood for some over-the-top indulgence, but not a fan of dairy? Well, then grab a spoon, because you're in luck. Ben & Jerry's has taken their decadent Coors line non-dairy. How does Boom Chocolata made of mocha and caramel sound? Or Bananas Foster with cinnamon and almond toffee pieces? It's pure euphoria without a drop of dairy. Find your next favorite at benjerry.com/non-dairy.
This episode is brought to you by Persephone Media House. It feels like sustainability is finally getting its moment, but still, it's a complex field changing at breakneck speed. Nobody knows this better than former Apple and Intel executive and host of the Sustainability Decoded podcast, Tim Moen. Joining Tim is co-host Caitlin Kinney, a young sustainability activist balancing the perspective from the front lines. With expert guests, they explore the world of sustainability, cut through the insider jargon, and explain what you need to know. Listen and subscribe to Sustainability Decoded with Tim and Caitlin now, before it's too late.
What are your business's supply chain challenges? Too much inventory? Too many disruptions? If you have a vision for improvement, Fastenal can tailor a solution to help you get there. From automated bins that monitor your inventory 24/7 to vending devices that let you control and track the products that keep your business running, Fastenal has the ability and experience to help your supply chain. To see how they do it, go to Fastenal.com/Spotify.
Welcome back. Before the break, we learned that solar, carbon offsets, and managing a regenerative farm won't work for our listener Diana right now. But we aren't giving up. There is one more idea we wanted to throw at her. So Diana, Rachel, and I all hopped in our rented Chevy Spark and headed out to see it in person. We drove about an hour south of Diana's property through these rolling grasslands dotted with oak trees.
We are driving through what looks like an oak savanna, which is one of my favorite biomes in Oregon.
Do you have a least favorite Oregon biome?
No. I don't think so.
Option number four that we wanted Diana to see is what is called a conservation easement, which is often an agreement between a landowner and a land trust. A land trust is basically a private nonprofit organization that protects land. And one of the things they do to protect land is through conservation easements, which, depending on the kind, can basically make a private national park out of your land. You continue to own your land, but the agreement with the land trust limits what can be done there, like development, mining, or subdividing the property. And it limits those uses forever, even if the property is sold down the road. The conservation easement can also reduce the cost of owning your land by lowering property taxes. And the land trust, in turn, can help you manage the property. To learn more about whether something like this might work for Diana, we went to see Claire Fox, the conservation director at Greenbelt Land Trust.
There are state governments and federal governments and county governments that have systems and ways to protect land, but the gears of government turn very slowly. And what I find amazing about conservation easements is that it can put conservation into the hands of everyday people.
There's all different kinds of easements with all different kinds of goals. But one way a conservation easement can be used is for habitat restoration. So in this case, taking farm fields out of use and restoring the native ecosystem. This can have a lot of environmental and climate benefits. Planting a native Oregon forest could sequester more carbon, provide habitat, and make the landscape more resilient to climate impacts like drought. To understand how this works, Claire took us to a 400-acre property outside a small town called Monroe, where Greenbelt has turned farms into forest.
So right now we're entering the corner of the property. We just walked through a big yellow gate, walked around a big yellow gate, on a very gravelly road.
Is this spirea that's blooming?
It is spirea.
I love spirea.
So spirea is that pink flowering plant that look like little pink spires. Yes, that's a native species. Pollinators love it.
We're in a big meadow full of young trees and flowers. And it is pretty hard to believe that not so long ago, this whole area was farmland. This property, like Diana's, was farmed for generations. But about 10 years ago, the families who farmed here decided they couldn't continue because the property was on a floodplain between a river and a long, skinny lake called an Oxbow Lake.
During flood events, the Oxbow Lake and the river connect, and all the back channels filled with water, and water spills into the field, which can really ruin an agricultural crop for that year. So over time, the farming family started to think about what might other options be for them, knowing that, you know, every 10 years or so, losing like a full year crop or multiple crops wasn't really penciling out economically.
The farming families wanted to find a way to keep the land in their families once they moved to farm elsewhere. So they reached out to Greenbelt. Now, Greenbelt won't just take any old plot of land. They want to make sure that preserving the land will make a big impact. So they have a long list of criteria they apply when looking at a project. Those criteria are also important in making a case for funding if they're applying for grants to help with the conservation work. So Claire took us through a list of some of the things that they're looking for. Number one is the size of the land.
For a land trust, often it takes a similar amount of effort to protect 5 acres as it does to protect 500 acres.
Check. This particular property was 400 acres. Number two, they want the land to ideally be connected to other protected lands to provide connected habitat for wildlife or trail connections for people to use. Check, this one was. Number three, they're looking to protect specific kinds of habitats and species. Also check, this property is a floodplain ecosystem.
You know, that's definitely one of the principal reasons why this project was really engaging to us and also to with the partners that we worked with, like the state and federal agencies, is thinking about watershed connectivity, flooding hazard, but also all of these species that depend on floodplain ecosystems to survive.
And once the conservation easement was in place, Greenbelt got to work reforesting the farmland by planting lots of trees and shrubs and grasses, with the goal of restoring an otherwise declining Willamette Valley habitat. And like John's regenerative bee pasture, this kind of work is not cheap.
All of that work cost ballpark $1.5 million through grants that we raised. And that checks out to about $4,000 an acre.
That's another big benefit of working with a land trust. they can go after donors or grants from state and federal agencies to fund this kind of ambitious restoration that would be really hard for landowners to pull off all on their own. And in less than a decade, this landscape has completely changed. Instead of 400 acres of flat farm fields, there's a young forest.
So on our left, you'll see that this is a planting that's a little bit older in age. It's doing a rocking job. Some of those cottonwoods are 15 feet, 20 feet tall by now, which is outrageous, but they're just doing their thing. Some of these other species, like we saw that little big leaf maple back there, those are some big leaf maple that are coming up pretty towering.
Is it fair to say these trees are sequestering carbon? They're sucking carbon in out of the air. Like, we are looking at sequestration here.
Yes, 110%. Yeah, I mean, again, these trees are growing like crazy, sequestering a lot of carbon within their trunks and boughs and leaves. That capturing of the carbon is happening like gangbusters out here.
So gangbusters that we ended up bushwhacking a little on our way home.
Okay, hold on a sec. Okay, these are all thistles. Okay. So they will prick your legs and you will feel it. I'm going to try and stamp them down as much as I can.
And you promise we're not lost?
I'm going to need to confer with my legal counsel before I answer that.
But eventually, we made it back to where we started, and we checked in with Diana about what we'd seen.
Diana, can you imagine, like, the wheat field in front of your parents' house looking like this within
oh,
a
yeah. tent? I mean, yeah, that would be this is beautiful. I would love for the land in front of my parents' house to look like this.
But there are some things that might make Diana's land less than ideal for a land trust like Greenbelt.
There are some things about the property that I go, ooh, I wonder if these are reasons a land trust would not be interested. We're not really close to a major town or urban center, pretty far out there. I don't believe there are any, you mentioned like connecting to other mm-hmm. properties, so like we definitely don't tick that box that I'm aware of.
I haven't visited your property or know the whole story, and I would want to learn more.
And we never say, like, no. on the first pass, right? It's a lot of, like, conversations. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of, you know, visits and stuff. It's yeah. not, it's not like there's any, like, hard stop.
And Claire also pointed out that Greenbelt is not Oregon's lone land trust. There are others with their own unique strategy and things they're looking for that Diana could reach out to as well. There are also resources for landowners looking to restore the land themselves.
There are other organizations and agencies. I'm thinking of watershed councils in your region. I believe it's the Pudding River Watershed Council.
Yeah.
That also has resources for private landowners to do restoration on their land and also, like, learn about techniques and funding sources and whatnot to pursue those kinds of activities.
So Diana left with a lot to think about. But before she made a final decision about what she wants to do, we wanted to give her one more thing to consider. Which of all the options we've looked at would provide the greatest climate benefit? So remember, we've talked about solar panels, regenerative agriculture, and reforestation, either through a conservation easement or carbon offsets. And to figure out which gives you the biggest climate benefit per acre, I talked to Paul West. He's a scientist at Project Drawdown, an organization that assesses climate solutions and sees which are the most effective. And I asked him about these options and said, based on pure carbon emissions, which would you pick?
I would say that if it is a good fit for a solar farm or a wind farm, that I would choose that in terms of the climate, first and foremost. In the U.S., a good fraction of our emissions are from electricity. So having a focus on reducing those emissions is top priority.
Solar and wind, he said, are the most urgent things to do. Getting coal and natural gas off the grid ASAP is a huge priority. And then, among the remaining options,
if it was not a good area for either solar or wind, but it is for forest, I'd restore a forest.
Reforesting the land will sequester more carbon than using it for agriculture will. So Paul's ranking for what Diana should do with her land from a pure carbon emissions perspective. First place, solar. Second place, reforestation. Third place, regenerative agriculture. But, Paul says, emissions aren't the only thing that can factor into a decision like this.
There are a number of benefits in terms of wildlife, or beauty, or water quality, holding more water in the soil, that it doesn't always have a value on it.
When we're talking about making changes for the climate, pure emissions aren't the only thing to consider. Reforesting and regenerative agriculture both have these adaptation benefits, things that can help keep the land more resilient in the face of extreme weather events and drought. So, when I got home from Oregon, I gave Diana one final call where we talked through everything: emissions, finances, community benefit, lifestyle. And this is where she landed.
If I had a magic wand and I could just do anything, it would definitely be the land trust option. I think that, while maybe doesn't sequester the most carbon, it sounds like it has a lot of benefits for the climate and for our ecosystems and absorbing like shocks of climate change that I find really valuable. And I think there's a part of me that just really responds and connects with the idea of restoring some of that back with mindfulness about what we should be planting on a different earth. So if I had a magic wand, I would be getting calls from all of these land trusts just begging to give me money to reforest. I do want to reach out to some land trusts and see if anyone is interested. I don't know if that'll work, but I feel really inspired to try and see what happens.
If that doesn't seem possible, she's intrigued by parts of John's model of regenerative farming.
I do like the idea of building connections in my community, seeing if there are any like farmers that are interested in renting our acreage, and working on building a relationship like that with one or many farmers. But in the long run, like, this is going to take a long time. Maybe in that time span, things around solar panels will change. Maybe best case scenario, conventional farmers will start getting more incentives to do the work that they're already doing with methods that are sequestering carbon and protecting habitat.
And we'll keep in touch to see how it all ends up.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Anna.
How to Save a Planet house call, complete. And that brings us to our patented How to Save a Planet calls to action. First, if you want to learn more about regenerative farming, check out the Soil Health Institute for lots of resources and our episode, Soil, the Dirty Climate Solution. And if you think the U.S. should offer more incentives to encourage regenerative farming, the Farm Bill, the big bill that lays out agricultural subsidies in the U.S., among other things, is up for a new version in 2023. On the conservation side of things, Claire recommends getting to know your local land trust, watershed council, or other conservation organizations and find a way to get involved. They probably have volunteer opportunities, educational programming, activities like tours and hikes, or exciting conservation projects that could use your help. And if you want to see a bunch of pictures from our trip to Oregon, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at howtosaveaplanet with the number 2, and subscribe to our newsletter at howtosaveaplanet.show. How to Save a Planet is a Spotify original podcast and Gimlet production. It's hosted by Alex Bloomberg, but this week by me, Anna Ladd. This episode was produced by me and Rachel Waldholz. The rest of our reporting and producing team includes Kendra Pierre-Lewis and Daniel Ackerman. Our supervising producer is Matt Schiltz. Our editor is Caitlin Kenny. Our intern is Janae Morris. Sound design and mixing by Peter Leonard, with original music by Peter Leonard and Emma Munger. Our fact checker for this episode is Claudia Geib. Special thanks to Lori Hutchinson. Thanks to all of you for listening. We'll see you next week.